This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York, Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman from UCLA.
Today, cancel culture. Our guests are Anna Muller from the University of Chicago and Seth Aberton from the University of British Columbia. Our discussion was recorded on Wednesday, March 13th, 2019. One concept that's been coming up in popular discussions recently is that of cancel culture. So that's the idea that once a public figure engages in a major moral transgression, they are to be erased and collectively ignored in our popular culture. It's happened to a bunch of celebrities in years past, some of which we've discussed on the show. For example, remember Roseanne got canceled over her Ambien tweets? Mm-hmm. We talked about R. Kelly earlier this year, Louis C.K. And now there's Michael Jackson. Leslie, you said this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And now comes the reckoning. And over the weekend, yeah. Tucker Carlson, who got recorded with a bunch of misogynistic things. And in each of these cases, well, maybe not R. Kelly anymore after the interview, but like a lot of them, defenders rise up and decry like this cancel culture. And you see this definitely with Michael Jackson, where I'm reading piece after piece that's like, oh, it was bad, but he's too big to fail. I've heard him described as that. We can't cancel him. And on the right, people said the same thing about Tucker Carlson. Like, so what's your view on this idea of cancel culture, the idea that we collectively erase those who transgress, you know?
Well, I want to go back to my perennial point, which I got from Ari Audit's work, well, close to 20 years ago now, which is that it's, well, not 20 years, like 15 years ago, he wrote his book on Scandal, which is that it's all about accusation, right? That Scandal is fundamentally not about transgression, it's about accusation. And in each one of these cases, it's like, these are things that were open secrets for a long time. And then there was an active accuser who made them salient. So in R. Kelly's case, you have the documentary and then the interview. In Michael Jackson's case, you have the documentary. But for both of these guys, we knew that they were pervs for like over 20 years.
Totally.
So like, when did R. Kelly marry a 15-year-old? It was like the early 90s, right?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we knew this about R. Kelly, I will say.
Yeah, and the first credible child molestation accusations against Michael Jackson were also in the early 90s.
Now you've done it. Now here comes Leslie, right? I'm guessing you're coming in to defend Michael.
I'm not coming in to defend Michael Jackson. What I'm saying, I'm coming in to say, I think that there's a difference between what we knew and how we knew it about R. Kelly versus Michael Jackson. Like with R. Kelly, we knew that he married Aaliyah and that she was 15. What we didn't know was he did it because he was seen having sex with her, right?
What's the difference? How many people do you know get married and you assume that they're not going to have sex?
What I'm saying is he married her because he'd had sex with her. And in order to sort of make sure her image stayed clean and he didn't get arrested for statutory rape, he married her like a week later.
Oh, so before that, we thought his intentions in marrying a teenage girl were honorable.
What I'm saying is he had a fan base. He had a fan base who thought that, whereas, you know, even the biggest fan, right, knowing that, well, he basically just did it because he was already sleeping with her, I don't know, might give them pause, right? So there's that. So we knew that. Then there was the tape, right? And it was very clear it was R. Kelly. It seemed pretty clear it was an underage girl, right? With Michael Jackson, like, he had someone who acted weird and looked weird, right? And then you had an accusation, but there wasn't the same amount of like salient material evidence with Michael Jackson than with R. Kelly. And so in some ways, I think it's understandable for people to have been like, you know what? Those are just people who are out to get money. Look at him. He's a mess. He can't do anything with himself. He's obviously crazy. So people are preying on him, right? And so I think that there's a difference both in terms of what we were like, okay, this is definitely fact, right, about these two men at the time. And also, too, the ways in which people, as a result, thought about the two men, like one being he's obviously a predator, and then the other one being looking at him and saying, look at him, he's so weak, he must just be prey.
Okay, so I would agree with that last sentiment. I think that the difference between Michael Jackson and his persona and R. Kelly and his persona were very important to how people perceived it. But I think 14 or 15 when Michael Jackson first was accused in 93. And even before that, two or three years before that, people knew that he was having sleepovers with underage children. And now, as you know, a dad of a three-year-old and a dad to be, and I think about it, would I send my kid, a 7 or a 10 or a 13-year-old kid, over to Michael Jackson's house to sleep over, or anybody's, random man's house or from the top? And the answer is no. So, I mean, a lot of adults were sitting there watching this, and, you know, I mean, he was huge. He was a superstar. And yes, he seemed weak and like, you know, he was very childlike. I think that was, you know, there's a lot of obviously abuse that happened to him when he was younger. And so there was kind of this weird, he's so soft kind of thing. I knew then something was weird. And the fact that it took so long for it to actually become a real legal issue and for people to sort of like a documentary to come out just still strikes me as bizarre. You know, 20 years later.
And the implicit contrast there is that R. Kelly's public persona and the content of his art has always been basically, you know, I'm a satyr. Mm-hmm. You know, he has a priapic artistic persona that fits pretty well with the accusations.
But can I ask a question? Like, if I look deep into my heart, I knew he was doing it. Like I felt strongly that he was doing it the whole time. And I'm sure I was just glancing past the issue in some way, like a self-imposed ignorance or blindness. Do you think that it was really a question, or do you think that we all kind of knew it, but we can't deny it anymore?
Knew what? Knew what? Okay, let's be clear. Knew what?
Knew that he had knew that Michael Jackson was having sexual contact with young boys.
I didn't.
You know what's scary? What's scary is the people around him had to have known, because the two that are on this documentary, one met him on that Pepsi commercial in the mid 80s, and he cultivated that relationship over a decade. So this kid was around him all the time, which should have been suspicious to everybody.
Yeah.
And the other one came in a few years after that. And he did the same thing with that kid where he cultivated the relationship. I think he was like a dancer on one of his videos or on like the live tour or something. And I mean, again, this is like, you know, in plain sight, on top of the fact that when I was young, I knew he was weird then too. He had a roller coaster in his backyard. He had a chimpanzee, which was really strange for, you know, the 90s.
But that was innocent weirdness.
Was it?
Right. No. I mean, that was his persona in the 1980s was like, no one in America, even Leslie would have agreed that Michael Jackson was a strange person, but he seemed asexually strange.
Yeah.
Right. He seemed, that was his image in the 80s, was Peter Pan.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, this is somebody who was, you know, everybody kind of knew that Joe Jackson abused the shit out of him. And so the kind of understanding was that this is someone who was kind of stunted in almost like a quasi Freudian sense of like, you know, developmentally stunted and kind of pre-sexual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure.
And so that was the persona, right? Everybody would agree he was weird, but you know, when, you know, buying the elephant man's bones and all that crap, you know, but buying the elephant man's bones or having a pet chimpanzee doesn't mean you want to sleep with kids.
Exactly. Right. And I think that there were some people who were predisposed to be like, oh yeah, it totally makes sense that he's sleeping with kids based on his other weirdness.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there were other people who were like, hey, you know, I mean, and maybe erring too much on the side of caution, saying, hey, just because he's weird doesn't mean you can convict him of doing these other things, right? So there's that. But then there's also, I mean, you're like, dude, what, you, even people who knew and found out that he was having these sleepovers with little kids, right? I'm sure everyone was like, I'm sure the parents must really trust and know this guy to be doing this, because it also accorded with that, you know, sort of like prepubescent, right? You know, I'm stunted growth, little kid. And all I really want to do is hang out with other little kids because that's when I find joy.
Yeah. Now, the part that should have made people suspicious was, you know, the sleepovers and especially getting the kids drunk. You know,
that. Yeah. I mean, you described a pedophile completely, like, enjoys having sleepovers with kids. I mean,
I'll tell you what did it for me was the hallway where there was a ding that went off when someone was headed towards the bathroom. Like, that's some Matt Lauer shit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, but I knew about this in the 90s. Like,
I didn't know about that.
The thing? Oh, I'm sure I saw it on a 2020 special.
I never heard of that before. It was like... Anyway, but the point is, let's get back to the accusation thing, right? So at the time, there was a plausible accusation, right? Let's not say it was definitive, but there was, because you can come up with these excuses and say, oh, well, maybe he's innocently weird, or maybe this is extortion, right? But at the time, there was a plausible accusation. And now there's like a much more focused accusation. And, you know, similarly, we have a focused accusation with R. Kelly, which is really just drawing us back to what we already knew at the time of the piss tape trial. And then, you know, likewise, you know, get back to the third case that we're talking about, Media Matters, basically, they are a professional accuser. The whole point of Media Matters is to find right-wing media personalities and accuse them of, you know, transgressions of various types, typically, you know, that they said something politically objectionable that they can cast in a unflattering light. But in this case, that he was, I didn't listen to the Love Sponge tapes, but, that he was basically, you know, joking around about creeping on teenage girls is my understanding of the synopsis. But so that's an accuser organization, right? That's their whole shtick.
Well, it seemed to me that it was, so there was that tape, and then people were digging in the archives again, or was it just recently? They were talking about Tucker Carlson and the things that he said about, you know, people from the Middle East, right?
Well, Media Matters, I mean, they basically, he's like one of their number one targets now. Like, they put out something about him constantly.
I mean, Gabriel, I mean, yeah. He's kind of a douche. I mean, I'm sorry to use that word. I mean, we have to be like scientific here. I think the scientific term is douchebag. Yeah. So, he kind of is.
Well, I'm not saying, I mean, I don't listen to his show or watch his show, but I'm just saying it makes a certain amount of sense that he's a prominent media personality on the right. And if you're a left-wing media criticism organization, he's a pretty good target.
I think there's a larger thing going on that I've noticed just in the last, I mean, I don't know, people call it that, the culture of outrage and whatnot. We're in a gotcha moment, right? And I'm not justifying what he said because it's pretty bad what he said. But I do, you know, and I'm now in Canada, so it's a little bit different here. There isn't sort of a right-wing movement against professors here, right? And if anything, it's the left against, like, say, a Jordan Peterson that is a more salient thing. But it just seems like everybody is sort of looking to get someone else to dig into all the things that have ever been said about any single individual. It's kind of stressful. It's really stressful.
So Seth, what's your opinion on cancel culture then? Like, do you see this as a negative thing, or should we be getting rid of people when they, you know, they transgress in these ways? Or
so, I mean, I don't know. It's so complicated. Anne and I were talking about this morning, you know, as a father, like thinking about the fact that I love Thriller. Mm-hmm. And I love that album so much. And I love, like, do we get rid of his Jackson 5 stuff? Like, where is the line? Do we, and you know, I'm really interested in baseball, for instance, and like the whole performance enhancement drug crisis, and whether people belong in the Hall of Fame, if it's a museum or not. And you know, there's this debate about where the cutoffs are. And I don't know, you know, like New Zealand, I was reading New Zealand has actually banned Michael Jackson's music. I don't know how effective it's been, but Well, if we ban it in the US, will you, or in Canada, will you see people like yelling at people playing it in their car? Or, you know, will that become another gotcha moment where, oh, you're, you know, a supporter of a pedophile? I don't know. It just seems.
Yeah, Seth, I was just thinking about that the other day because I was walking down the street and someone was listening to Michael Jackson. And I was like, oh, my God, in a year or so from now, like if someone heard him doing that, they might like throw things at him.
Right. I mean, it just seems like that's just another thing that people could use as a mark of stigma, right? That this person's a bad person. I don't know.
I'm just amused that you went to Thriller because that's exactly the Chappelle Show skit in the same episode where he's doing the piss on you video.
Right.
Where he's like, you know, he's like trying to say what amount of evidence would it take to convince him of various people being guilty of crimes. He's like, Thriller, man, Thriller.
No, it's true, man. It is very true.
For me, there's kind of like two separate issues here. And one has to do with like cancel culture and like, and this sort of like Twitter mob and this like, you know, this court of like public opinion that has become so intense right now. And then a separate issue around realizing that some groups of individuals, whether it's like the children that were abused by priests or by Michael Jackson, or whether it's women and the, you know, ridiculous amount of harassment and abuse that that women often face in society. And there's sort of like the Me Too coming, you know, reckoning movement and speaking out about abuses. But then there's this, like, to me, the cancel culture, I mean, they're in this, you know, Michael Jackson, you know, example, they're overlap, but to me, they're also separate issues. You know, when you first mentioned cancel culture, I actually read a different article this week related to it. It was an opinion piece in the New York Times called Teen Fiction and the Perils of Cancel Culture.
I read that.
Yeah, which is all about this like young adult, you know, book written by a queer Black young author. I think it was one of his, maybe his debut novel. And basically, even though it was under contract and all set to be released, basically Twitter went to town on him and said that, you know, he didn't have a sort of a right to write a novel about a place that he hadn't personally experienced. And
Anna, what's so crazy about that, and I actually wonder whether or not that would have been the response if it weren't for the fact that it had been his job to actually check people in the same way.
I know the irony.
And he had been drawing lines around who could and could not inhabit certain characters and who could and couldn't write about certain characters. And it was like, oh, I can tell you who you can't write about, but I can write about whoever I want. And so, I don't know, it kind of reminded me of that Black Mirror episode.
Which one?
The one with the likes and how if you get below a certain number of likes, you're basically just, I mean, you're like a total outcast, which is hard, which what the crazy thing about that episode, right, is that like all through that process of acquiring likes and then watching yourself lose likes, like you were so caught up and anxious and so messed up in the head. But then as soon as you dip below a certain point, you're just like, oh, this is kind of freeing. Like, F this. I don't have to play by these rules anymore. So, I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel like, you know, cancel culture, I think in some ways, if it doesn't go too far, can be an effective tool of ensuring that people adhere to norms, right? But then when it goes too far, then, you know, people can swing the other way. People can just say, who cares?
The problem is that there's always somebody looking. It's like Seth says, there's always somebody looking for the gotcha moment, right? Like, are all those cheering for Tucker Carlson to get booted out are probably precisely the same ones who would be unhappy when Bill Maher gets the same treatment, right? So it's like, it's hard to tell. It's a legitimate issue. I find it interesting because people from all sides are getting hit by it now, this cancel culture. On the liberal side, what's her name? Who had the, who was charged with being anti-Semitic by her colleagues, right? Like
Ilhan.
Ilhan Omar. That's it. Like, she's also subject to, it's coming on all sides. I think there's some type of sense that like there is a mob and nobody's safe from it. You've been listening to The Annex, a sociological podcast. Special thank you to Anna Muller of the University of Chicago and Seth Aberton from the University of British Columbia. We're on the web, www.sociocast.org/annex, on Twitter at @SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for having us.
Bye. Thanks.